From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse Bureau. Thanks so much for joining me today. We're talking about Hmong farmers and the important role that they play in our community. And we're talking about a new effort to support their important work, which is a cooking show that's doubling as a fundraiser. The host of that show is with us today, Bo Shan, and I'm very glad to welcome her to Newsmakers. Bo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're talking about the limited series cooking show, 12 episodes, I think, Cooking with Bo. And yes. We're also talking about the effort that is supporting, which is for Independent Hmong Farmers Corporation, which you are the founder of. Talk to me about where the idea for starting this foundation to help the Hmong farmers came from.
Well, since my parents have been Hmong farmers vendors in La Crosse County since 2004, and in the years that I've worked with them, I've seen the struggles they experienced. And all our neighbors, all the Hmong farmers, have similar struggles, such as food loss, profit loss, and various financial struggles. And being a part of an underrepresented group really pushed me to want to advocate for these farmers. In the first years, about a year and a half into starting this nonprofit, my goal was to shine a light on these Hmong farmers, mm-hmm. who they are. We featured some of the local gardens, some of their specialty items like fresh ginger, bitter melons, mustard greens. I wanted to share more correct information about who the Hmong farmers are and what they grow, because in the past years, and even this year recently, we would have customers that would ask me where our food comes from. And some of them would even ask me if we got them from China or Mexico, which boggles my mind a little bit, because I know that's what the box that we use say, because we get these boxes donated from different places, such as Festival Foods and the local Asian markets. We just like to reuse these boxes, and sometimes it's hard to find industrial containers, the crates.
Plus, it's smart to recycle, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So we just have these boxes that have been sitting around in the garage for decades that we reuse. So I would give these customers who are asking the correct information, and I just love to point them to the nonprofit page, because we feature gardens and we feature the different markets that these growers grow to. So also, we also did, my family and I also donated our time and resources to an episode of Wisconsin Foodie in 2020. So that was great that people can actually just watch the episode and see our garden and the markets that we go to. But yes, so far, that's what the nonprofit was aiming to do, was to help advocate for them. I would relay to the market managers and help interpret for the individual vendors that need interpretation. But other than that, this year was crucial to start raising funds because of the pandemic that the farmers had experienced through last year and even the year before that, because of the impact of the pandemic was so drastic and negative for their business, for any small business, which they are.
Yeah. And you talked about how close to home this hits for you, because your parents are farmers whose goods are part of these markets that the farmers go to. Did you grow up in the garden, so to speak?
Yes. I mean, from a small age, my mom was always a farmer, even just to grow to help sustain our family. But she, that was part of her livelihood. Like, she would grow to sell her produce, and she's really good at that. So all through my life, I just remember like going to the garden really early in the morning before school, and then heading back to the garden after school. So I was always dirty.
What's the first thing you remember growing?
Sugar snap peas.
Oh, yum.
Yeah, Yes, and it's great because if you're harvesting super early in the morning around 5:30 a.m. and you get hungry, just snack on them.
Who needs breakfast, right?
Right.
So you talked about sort of having to set the record straight with some people about yes, this is local fo food grown in our actual community.
Yes.
What kinds of foods are they growing and bringing to market? It's a lot more than just foods used in traditional Hmong cooking, isn't it?
Oh
Yeah.
yes. So it's seasonal produce that grows in this region, which can vary from cucumbers, kale, cabbage, carrots, beets, rhubarb. We have so much of rhubarb throughout the entire season, and we have fresh strawberries and raspberries. There's tomatoes. There's all kinds of tomatoes. There's cherry tomatoes and big Florida 91 tomatoes, which are like slicing tomatoes. You have your grape tomatoes and you have potatoes. They vary from just all kinds of vegetables that you can think of that you can find in the market, like green onions and cilantro and mint, to the specialty items, which are fresh ginger and bitter melon and mustard greens and bok choy. Gosh, there's just so many. I can't list them all. But
Gardening.
yes, there's, I'm sorry, go
No,
ahead.
please finish your thought. Go ahead.
Long green beans. A lot of people get so struck by them when they see these long green beans that like probably stretches to 2 to 3 feet long,
Oh, wow.
and and you can eat them raw. They're delicious. You can eat them with dip, or you can cook them or saute them however you want. They're just like a really delicious, healthy, different strand of green beans that I think people should start trying more.
I know in the second half of our conversation, we're going to talk a lot more about cooking, but those big long green beans sounds like they'd be good like on the grill. They're long enough that they won't like fall through. That'd be amazing.
Yes, and they're just a little like the texture's a little different and the taste is different, but it's still very nutritious and delicious.
That sounds great. So you were talking about you know how difficult it is for the farmers, the work that they do. Gardening is a difficult prospect anyway, especially if you're growing food in any quantity. How much of a household's income for these farmers is dependent on their farming?
For most farmers, they fully depend on the annual income from farmers market every year. For many, this is their trade and their livelihood. We do have some vendors that are either part-time or do work full-time, but because of the pandemic, I would say again, that has greatly affected the outcome of who has a job and who doesn't anymore.
Yeah, and this is not the first time that we've heard about the pandemic and its economic effects on our program. But talk about from the perspective of the Hmong farmers that you work with, what was it about that pandemic year that hit them so hard?
So, since the pandemic, some of the Hmong farmers had to make tough decisions on how they should invest in starting up their small businesses every year again, such as purchasing seeds, how much land to rent and work moving forward, what repairs are worth fixing, like tillers and work vehicles, how many markets to attend because there are booth fees. That has not gone down since the pandemic, so I think it's still the same, or some of them have raised their prices on the booth fees. And one Hmong farmer vendor closed their business last year and decided to reopen this year. But the amazing part was that despite all this loss and negative effects of COVID in 2020, all the Hmong produce vendors are were still able to donate to local food banks and pantries, such as the Hunger Task Force, as they have been doing for years prior.
That's amazing. So the even while they're experiencing a lot of need, they're still reaching out to others in need as well.
Yes, because I think it's a loss-loss. If they don't sell all their food, I don't think anybody has a refrigerator system big enough to hold all of it. So it's best to donate it to the needy. Otherwise, some of it do end up back in the garden and get recycled back into the land.
Okay. So you talked about the different markets that your farmers are active in. How many farmers do you I don't know if represent is the right word, but how many farmers are you connected with, and which markets are they part of?
Are you asking me how many farmer vendors I'm
Yeah,
connected with?
right.
So, I mean, I know a few of them very well through like relations in just the past couple of years that I've got to know them personally, but and some of them are related to my parents. So about a handful, like five vendors, but then just acquaintance wise, everyone knows everyone. So I know about 15 vendors total. Every vendor at the Onalaska Festival of Foods, I know all of them, and then the Cameron Park one as well.
Okay. And your organization for independent Hmong farmers, is that organization like a membership type organization, or do you just
No.
represent all of them, writ large?
No, so there's no membership. I am just like operating this all by myself, and
Okay.
I am I'm a media major, so I also have a small team that like would donate their time to like help me either do media work or just however we can to advertise and highlight these Hmong vendors. And everyone's inclusive. It includes every vendor. Every week I try to highlight a different vendor or their produces or their flowers. Or just their faces. I try to get them to smile because they're so reserved. It's hard to like ask them, "Hey, can I take a photo of your produce or your booth?" And they're so willing. Yes, take them. But then it's like they're shy. They're camera shy. So I would have to ask them, "Can you smile for the camera?" And obviously they request me like, "Please don't post it up anywhere that would embarrass me." But I would always tell them, no, this is for the nonprofit and is to help tell people where you are and what you have and what's going on in our cities, especially like to keep things current and updated so people will know where to go to shop.
Do you find that people are eager to embrace the concept of shopping at a farmer's market, or do you have trouble getting the message out to all the people that are still, have all this fantastic produce around them and they're still going to run into the grocery store?
Yes, right. So I mean, we have, I think it's a mixed group. We have some amazing people in town and that just are so supportive of the market that would spend there instead of going to the grocery store. But we do still have some customers that want lower prices or don't understand the concept of how fresh this food is. It was harvested this morning or the night before to get it here to you by 7 a.m. and it's fresh and it's like most of them are organic. I know that some Hmong farmers are not certified organic because they do rent the land. It does not belong to them. But they've been there for more than a decade or two. So the food, you cannot get something better than this for the prices they're asking for in the grocery stores. It's literally farm to table. If that's what people are looking for, to eat fresh and to eat healthy. And I don't know, to get their money's worth. Like some of these produce are bundled up so big for $2. And it still makes you wonder, like some people who don't understand how hard these farmers are working would ask for them to lower their prices or give them a deal or ask like, can we get this two for the price of one? And I'm like, but then that's making the farmers lose out on profit because and it's a lose-lose situation for the farmers because you don't want it if they're not going to lower their prices. But then if you want it, you want two for the price of one, and that's still that they're still at a loss for that. So, but I am encouraging people to shop local and to eat like the fresh produce they get locally that's available to them all the way from spring to the end of fall.
The La Crosse area is somewhat unique in that most, if not all of the sort of major grocery type outlets are somewhat locally owned. They're not like big national chains, most of them.
No.
But when you talk about buying from an actual farmers market vendor, like from a farmer vendor like you're working with, like 100% of what you're spending with that vendor goes in to support their home or it goes back into their garden.
It's
like the economic impact of that can't be overstated.
Yes. And there's a research, there's like some research that was done in, I don't know, 2016 or 2017, that the market at Cameron Park alone on Fridays bring in a huge amount of money into the businesses around the farmers market. In that one season year, it brought well over $2 million into the business that surround the market. And I feel like that's such a great thing for people to just invest back into their community.
Yes. We're talking with Bo Sean about Hmong Farmers and her nonprofit for Independent Hmong Farmers Corporation. We're also going to be talking to her about an exciting new venture that she has going on, which is the limited video podcast series called Cooking with Bo. And that is produced by La Crosse Local, among others. And we're going to talk about that after this quick timeout. If you'd like to get in touch with our program, you can email us. It's newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. You can stream previous episodes of our show online as well. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to have you check out our catalog of episodes going back years and years. We'll be right back after this. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse talking with Bo Sean of Cooking with Bo, also of the For Independent Hmong Farmers Corporation. Bo, I'm excited to hear about this this podcast, this show that you've got all about the stuff you like to cook. Tell me how this idea came about.
Obviously, I wanted to raise funds for the Hmong farmers, and at first I was making small craft for sale, for private sales, like just to family members to help donate to the cause. And all throughout the year, I would cook random dishes and post them. I don't know why, but I would post them on social media. And
it's the modern way. If you cook something, it didn't happen if you didn't put a picture of it on Instagram, right?
Right. People need to know what I ate that night for dinner. But people would always request a recipe to the point where I had this friend, Abram from Abe's Rave, request quite a few of my recipes. And I made a joke and I said, I would teach you, but I have to charge. And he was up for it. He was like, yeah, teach me, charge me. But one day Dylan Overhouse from Dylan Overhouse Production and I were talking about, you know, starting a cooking show. And he was like, we should definitely do it as a fundraiser. We should bring it to La Crosse Local and we should partner with Mike Makes and we should ask Abram from A's Raves to host it with us. And we should get some other guest hosts, you know, to just like cook with us. It would be a fun show and see where that goes. And we should make it free to the public. And that was such a great idea. And so, I mean, we pitched it to everybody and everyone said yes. No one said no to us. So that was amazing. It was a great turnout that everyone was so willing to jump on board to do this silly, fun cooking show that I swear there in every episode, something went wrong. And but it was such a good time and we ate really well. So,
but that's the thing that I love about it is that it, because I cook often in my kitchen from, I live in an extended family kind of situation and I cook for the household often and never do I make anything when something doesn't go wrong. So like, that's just, your show's very real and very approachable because you end up with fantastic food at the end of the day, but there's always the real person aspect to it. It doesn't look all staged and produced and everything. How important was that sort of familiar approach?
I mean, that's really important to us to just, I'm a home cook. So to just make it look like I'm cooking at home and, to have the right kitchen, and we tried forever to look for one until one of our producers, Brent from La Crosse Local, just offered his kitchen to us, which was amazing. But yeah, that's really important to us to just make it look as authentic as possible. We thought about live streaming. We were really for live streaming the show, but we were smart enough to do a test episode first, like a test pilot first, to see how things would go. And so many things went wrong, and we're just like, okay, let's just film these episodes first and edit some of the small things out, and then we can show the rest of the world.
Yep. So you were talking, or you were doing 12 episodes of the show. How easy or hard was it to sort of narrow down what I'm sure is an extensive list of cultural favorites to these 12 episodes?
I think I changed the menu twice. I originally had a few other dishes on there, and then I cut it down to 12, only because of time and everyone's schedule. Everyone's so busy, and everyone did donate their time and their resources and their talents.
And as people watch the episodes, they learn more and more about you and your family's history and your background. So your family, as I understand it from watching the show, started in Laos, and then you were born in Thailand before coming to the United States. Have I got that right?
Yes.
How have the experiences and the food cultures of all of those different places that have touched your family's lives made their way into your cooking, or more broadly, kind of traditional Hmong cooking as it exists now?
So yes, our culture's greatly influenced by the food of older, like all the other regions that we've lived in. For example, like you said, my parents are born and raised in Laos, so we do love a lot of Laotian food, like paella salad. We use a lot of fish sauce in all our foods, which their culture does as well. There's just a kapung dish that's a Lao dish as well, and it's a curry dish, and it's delicious, and we just put a little twist on it to that we made our own to make it our own. And in Thailand, you know, like there's pad thai, there's so many different types of foods. But and I was telling somebody, like, because they asked me, is egg rolls strictly a Hmong egg roll? No, it's not. I mean, we have a version of the Hmong egg roll, which comes with like glass noodles, but there are so many different versions of egg rolls all throughout Asia. I mean, like in China, they make it differently. And in Vietnam, they make it differently. In Laos, they make it differently. And pho is a Vietnamese dish, and it's greatly inspired and influenced in many different cultures. We eat it in Thailand, we eat it in Laos, and we eat it here in America. It's such a hearty, clean, brothy dish that everyone just enjoys.
You distracted me when you started talking about pho. That's the third episode of the series, and it can be put together in a few hours, you know, simmering on the stove, or it can be a days long project. But but other recipes that you've shared can come together pretty quickly. Is there a particular episode that you're eager for people to see who might be sort of uninitiated and just want to give it a go?
So there's an episode, Bitter Melons, that we just like stir fried some bacon and then add in the bitter melons. And no one has to use bitter melon. You can use cabbage. You can use any other vegetable you want. You can't mess that dish up. You literally just chop up the bacon, throw it in the pan, fry it up, and then throw in the vegetables and fry it up. Like you can only have to salt it. The bacon's salty enough. It takes minutes. The bacon probably cooks up within like 5 to 7 minutes. And then your vegetables, however soft you want them, you can take your time on that. But no one can mess up that dish.
Do you have a favorite that you're most eager for people to learn about?
A traditional Hmong dish is rice, any kind of rice, white rice or sticky rice, and then some kind of meat, either boiled, steamed, or baked or grilled, and then any kind of vegetable you want. And that's a basic Hmong dish. And we have an episode that does pork belly with sticky rice, and then we have some greens on the side. And I just want people to experiment with that. Like, do what you want with that dish, make it your own, and try new things, try different kind of meats or vegetables. But it comes with like a spicy sauce, like a bell peppers on the side, and that's really all we need for it to be a complete like traditional Hmong dish.
That sounds really good. Now, you've got different people cooking with you. You mentioned Abram from Abe's Raves, who joined you on several of the episodes, but you've also got other guest hosts working with you. Who are some of the people who you are featuring this season?
Yes, so we have Gus Simple from Aris Global Imports. We have Mayor Mitch, the mayor of La Crosse. We have Josh from the Dirty Dozen Donuts. We have Mario from Beer by Bike Brigade. And then again, Abram Dyke from Abe's Raves. They're all incredibly
fun.
Yes, but they're so fun to cook with. And we learn new things from each other. Like, we share stories and cooking tips. There's always something silly going on the set while we're cooking. So it was such a good experience.
And it's the best kind of show to do because there's food after.
Yes.
and before and during.
Yeah, but I like the part where we tell each other stories of our backgrounds, about our families, about what we cook. If you're just getting to know somebody, I mean, I've met some of them before, but I haven't really spent that kind of quality time with them. And it's silly that it's on camera the whole time, but I've learned so much about the person I was cooking with. And I think that's one way you can really learn about and understand a person is if you cook and eat with them, share a meal with them.
Do you see another, you did 12 episodes this season. Do you see another season coming, or is that something that you'd like to do?
We were kind of joking about it, that if people request it, we would do special holiday episodes for like Halloween and then the Hmong New Year, usually the traditional ritual Hmong New Year is at the end of November, which is like around Thanksgiving. And then there's the Christmas holiday, that we would do like holiday episodes. And then maybe next year we might do another season, but we don't know. I want to keep doing this because it's such a good cause. And I think it would really benefit the Hmong farmers as small businesses to keep having an outlet like this to help them. But I don't know if people like it, you know, comment below, tell us you like our show and, you know, request for more if you want.
So it is a fundraiser. And as of this taping, we got some news today about your progress. Why don't you share how the fundraising aspect of the effort is going?
Through all our sponsors and some individual donors and Mario from Sabadash, our goal is around 6,500, but right now we're at 5,500. And our goal was at 6,500 because we wanted to raise at least $500 per Hmong produce vendor to help them offset some of the loss and financial expenses that they're experiencing. But we hope to raise more. We hope to exceed our goal. And that's where we're at currently.
So if people want to find out information about the fundraising side of the operation, how can they find that info?
If they go to lacrosselocal.com or if they go to just the La Crosse Local web Facebook, there's links to a GoFundMe page and links to all the videos that they can watch and more information on how they can help donate.
You kind of got ahead of my next question, which is where people can find Cooking with Bo. I found it on YouTube. Just by searching for La Crosse Local, but I suppose, as you mentioned, it's on all their platforms.
Yes, it is across their platforms, and it's really great that they can just host this show for us.
It's a really interesting project, and I'm very appreciative of your joining us to talk about it. Thank you a lot, Bo.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Bo Sean is the host of Cooking with Bo, and she is the founder of For Independent Hmong Farmers Corporation. And we've been talking with her about Hmong farmers in the Coulee region and the important role that they play in our community, and a little bit about how we can support all of them. So that is good work indeed. So if you enjoyed this conversation, would like to listen to it again, or if you want to check out a previous episode of Newsmakers, you can find them all at our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. Coming up, we're going to be doing a little storytelling. That's next on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall, once again in our studio in La Crosse. We're talking now, turning our attention to storytelling. How to do it? Just what goes into a good story? How do you craft a tale that's worth telling? And we're talking about it, of course, because coming up is the La Crosse Storytelling Festival, and we'll get more information on that coming up in just moments. But first, let me introduce you to our guests today. We've got Kay Elmsley Whedon, who is from Stoughton via England via everywhere else. Kay, welcome. Welcome to Newsmakers today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we've got Terry Visger, who's joining us, who is a storyteller via her experience in the classroom and now doing it even more broadly. Terry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I should say each of these women has a website that you can visit. TalesByTerry.com is Terry's website, and KTales.com is Kay's website. So yes. Check those out. And we're going to be talking about the Storytelling Festival in just a moment. But Kay, let me start with you. We're talking about the art of storytelling. How does somebody know if they have a story that someone else might be interested in hearing?
I think the first thing that you notice is the level of interest that someone, if someone is paying attention to you or what you have to say when you start to tell a story. So if you're just beginning to tell a story, then I think that's kind of how you launch into it. I think that's just the natural state of storytelling that we all have. We all have that ability to tell somebody what had just happened or remember the time when, or you're never going to believe this. So I think that you base that completely on the attentiveness and the reaction ability of the people around you. But if you're going to come up with your own story, I think you have to keep that in mind. What is it that you want to convey? What's the heart of the story? What is the story doing for you? So oftentimes when I create and write stories, it feels almost like there's something inside me that I just have to get out. There's a reason for telling this story. And then to tell it in a way that will capture other people's attention. And sometimes it's a little difficult to put that together because when you put those stories in motion, you don't often have the audience there. And then when you think you've just got it perfect and you're standing up in front of an audience, it just changes all over again. So it becomes very much something that you work with the audience and you react as they react. And so I think it has those elements to it.
I have a friend who's a stand-up comic, and it seems like maybe a similar process.
It is. There's very much a lot that's similar in those two affairs, right?
They tell stories too, but theirs are just usually shorter.
Yeah, yes. Shorter.
But I mean, that's what they are.
And designed to be humorous. A lot of your stories, I imagine, have humorous elements, but there are also stories that are told for dramatic effect or for emotional impact. How does each storyteller go about, maybe Terry can handle this one, how does each storyteller go about discerning which kinds of stories are best suited for their particular voice?
I think it is practice. I do know that, you know, I love to tell scary stories, but in asking our tellers this time if they would like to share a story on our ghost story night at the festival, Bill Lepp, who is a hilarious storyteller, said, no, I'm not good at ghost stories. And so after a while, we just all sort of get used to the kind of story that we're drawn to, and we probably perfect that that way. And obviously he has. He's very funny. Kevin Kling, who's coming, he takes you from humor to tears back to humor again. He seldom tells folk tales. He almost always just tells personal tales. So I think everybody sort of finds their niche and they run with that.
Kay, when did you first realize that you were endowed with such an ability?
Well, I had a local librarian who asked me to come to the library and read some stories to the children in English and Spanish. So I took one of the books that's written in both English and Spanish, and I would read them the book in English and they would be fine. And then I would read it to them in Spanish and I would just lose them because they didn't know what I was saying. And so I finally just smacked the book closed and said, okay, you know what? I'll just tell you this part in Spanish. And I just started to throw in some Spanish words, and you know, it was, I'll never forget. I was stunned by the process. I went right back to my middle school classroom that I had taken an hour off of to come to the library and tried it out on them. And I couldn't believe what it did for seventh graders. So wow. I often do a lot of bilingual Spanish English tales because it just has always worked for me. And I've really enjoyed the use of language.
I noticed when I was looking on your website, it features the fact that you're a bilingual storyteller, and yeah. I wondered if you share the same story, if the same stories work in English and Spanish, or if you find yourself leaning in toward different stories depending on which language you're telling.
I find myself leaning toward different stories because I then have the ability to do some more cultural stories, some that are more authentic and some that are drawn from Hispanic culture. Once in a while, I could take a story that is, you know, from, I don't know, some English culture and just change it to an English-Spanish story. But I'm more drawn to the ones that have Hispanic bits and pieces about them.
Terry, what about you? When did you first realize that you wanted to tell stories in front of people?
Well, my mom always called me a little liar, so I think it started early. But when I was first married, my husband was a camp counselor at Camp Bradfield in La Crosse. In fact, there was a picture of it in the newspaper on Sunday. And I was still in college. I was 20 years old. We got married young then. And I was fascinated watching the counselors take 60 boys ages 8 to 12 who were, I think the technical term is bazoobi, and they would start once, and these kids would just calm down, and they were enthralled with what was going on. And I thought, I can use that. I was in college for education, and so I started using it in my classroom and saw how much, how it worked, how well it worked. So I just continued all along and telling in my classroom, and then about 2000, then I started telling what we call professionally, where people ask us to come and tell somewhere besides our classroom.
I want to make sure that we spend ample time talking about the actual festival in which both of you play a role. The La Crosse Storytelling Festival, information about that is online at lacrossestoryfest.com. Talk about what's going to be going on at this year's festival.
Our festival is pretty much set. We kind of like the way that it has always gone. We have moved from a tent in Myrick Park to the Pump House. They were gracious to invite us and encourage us to come. So Friday night is still the Tales of the Creepy and Scary. We start out very, very mildly, and then the stories increase in intensity. And except for our featured teller, Kim Wykamp, all of the tellers are local tellers. This is kind of our time to shine. They're all from the Bluff Country Tail Spinners. On Saturday, we have children's programming, and this year it is completely free. There is a charge for Friday night and the other times, but the children's programming is free because of a donation by our sponsor, Arla Clements. And so we have Hans Mayer, we have international storyteller Bill Lepp, we have magician Isaiah Foster, and we also have some activities for the children that are sort of geared toward storytelling. The afternoon is our featured tellers, Bill Lepp, Kim Wykamp, and Kevin Kling, plus musician Arian Leiden. Then we have our Luna. La Crosse is I think we're kind of famous for our Luna. And if you're a fan of public radio and you know the moth, the Luna is our version of the Luna. And so we invite anyone to come and tell a 5-minute true-ish story. And then the evening is our adult cabaret, which still, again, features our three international tellers. But this year also, we will be joined by Bo Zong, who is a local Hmong writer. And Bo is a first-generation Hmong woman who is compiling folk tales of the Hmong culture to put in books, and her books will be for sale. And we convinced her, even though she's not really told stories before, to tell one. And I heard it the other night, and she's going to be great.
We have a
nice range of people.
We talked to Bo earlier on this program about her cooking show.
Yes, she's awesome, isn't she? She's just a delightful woman. Yep.
So, Kay, you and Terry were commenting on what an interesting sort of really privilege it is that storytellers of such national renown are three of them going to be part of the festival this year.
Exactly. I sometimes have to pinch myself and wonder how we got so lucky. One of my favorite activities is every year traipse down to the National Storytelling Festival that takes place in Jonesboro, Tennessee, where thousands upon thousands of people clamor into these tents and watch these storytelling amazing powers from around the world and nationally as well. And three of them that are always featured there are the three that we are having here in La Crosse. So we just are so exceptionally lucky to be able to have Bill, Kim, and Kevin joining us all in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I mean, it's the sort of thing that you would spend a lot of time and energy getting to and a lot of money buying tickets. And here they are in a nice small size theater right here in La Crosse.
So do storytellers know each other, look up to each other, follow each other in the same way that musicians kind of know each other?
Yes, it's very much like that. Very much. Yeah, that they travel together. They put on shows together. They connect with each other. They bounce off each other. And it was actually through one of the storytellers that I learned that connecting with storytellers is much better for your profession than just trying to go it alone and not let them know what you're doing because you don't want to give them the action. It's turned out to be so true. So they're definitely a group of people that enjoys talking to begin with and hobnobbing with other people. And it just spreads the wealth of the power of story.
Speaking of that, I was interested in storytelling is just such a part of every culture, like, you know, campfire stories or, you know, passing down either family lore or religious traditions or all these things that we connect with storytelling. And it's just such a powerful medium. Terry, before our conversation began, you indicated that you have a particularly poignant way to express the power of storytelling.
I like to start a lot of the programs that I do, especially if I'm talking to adults and convincing them that yes, story is the way our brains work. And I have scientific data on that. But I start with this story. Long ago in Japan, it was the tradition if a wanderer was in need of food or a place to sleep, they would go to a dojo, a school of martial arts. And there, after challenging the students to a fake fight, they would be given food and lodging. And so it was that an old storyteller could tell by the setting sun and the growl in his stomach that it was time to find such a place. He didn't go far when he came to a dojo, but this wasn't just any dojo. This was the dojo of the most famous samurai in Japan. He went to the door and knocked. It was opened by a student. Konnichiwa. I would like to challenge your master. Old man, challenge the first year students. Then we'll give you some food and a place to sleep. I wish to challenge your master. Old man, challenge the second-year students. They use wooden swords. It's a fake fight. to challenge the master is a real sword, a real fight. I challenge your master. And so word was sent to the great samurai. He stood and then put on his gi. And then he wrapped his long obi round and round his waist and picked up his sharp and heavy katana and placed it in his obi. And then he went out to meet his challenger. The two men met in the middle of the room, one tall and strong, the other old and bent. They bowed. The great samurai stepped back, took out his katana, ready to strike. When the old man said, "Far away, in a beautiful mountain village, a young girl is lying by a stream. She's crying." The samurai put down his sword. His student said to him, "Sensei, sensei, what are you doing? You would have won." He sighed and turned to them and said, "Were you not listening? Did you not hear when I said that when in battle, you must be in the moment? You must stay focused. But this man, this old man, he took me to a place I have never been to before." And that is the power of storytelling.
Wonderful.
Great story.
Thank you for sharing that, Terry.
You're welcome. I love that story.
It just is interesting to consider how when we're hearing a story and we really in a way leave in our mind's eye the place where we are and we're taken somewhere else away from our problems or whatever it is that's going on.
Right. Well, and you know, it really is the way that our brains developed throughout the years. You know, people have been telling stories since they started talking. To adults, I always say, you know, contrary to popular opinion, I think storytelling is the oldest profession. college students don't get that, but it is. It's been around in every single culture. Many cultures still continue it much more than we do in the United States. But it is. It makes our brains active on both sides.
Yeah, you were talking about that before you began your story. You were saying that data actually shows how our brains kind of work through storytelling. How really it's kind of the natural way for us.
Right, because you're using. I call it the universal learning style, and I didn't make that up. Somebody else did, but you're using all of the things that you would need for learning. So you are visualizing the teller, you are hearing them, but also you have the kinesthetic where you are bringing in the emotion, fun or sadness or whatever those things are. They've done PET scans with children and found that the two places where their brains are mostly active are in spontaneous play, another of my passions, and storytelling. Otherwise, like if they're watching a video, most of their brain activity is gray, but with spontaneous play, not directed by an adult, and storytelling, their brains light up. So ours do too.
Yeah. And Ezra, I just wanted to mention to you when you had said how that takes you away. I remember several times doing storytellings with children, and then afterwards the kids would draw the stories and just the differences that they were sure that you were telling the story about a black cat or a red car or a blue car or just the whole difference. It's so amazing. And you can see that you just see their faces and they're being taken away. And at some point in time, you feel as though you could say anything. They're just hanging on to your words. And so it's, wow, it's the, what did they say? The original social media.
You know, Kay, that's interesting that you phrase it that way, because I remember your earlier comment about how you can craft what you think is just a perfect story in the privacy of your own space, and then you share it with an audience and realize it does or doesn't work, or this needs to change, or this, you know, the audience responds to it differently. And it's almost like, you know, what you were saying about the children, like you're the storyteller, but the story really in that sense does belong to the listener.
It does. Yes, very much so. Very much so.
So we've been talking about the La Crosse Storytelling Festival with Kay Elmsley Whedon online at ktales.com and Terry Visger online at talesbyterry.com. Terry, when is the Storytelling Festival? Not this weekend, but next weekend, right?
Next weekend, July 23rd and 24th. So in the evening on the 23rd, Friday evening, and all day on Saturday from 10 in the morning until 9:30, 10 o'clock at night.
And information available at lacrossestoryfest.com. Terry, thank you very much for being here.
And tickets, okay. Tickets are available at thepumphouse.org.
Okay, sounds good. Tickets at the Pump House. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Kay, thank you very much for your time as well.
Thank you, Ezra. It was a delight to be on the show.
Newsmakers is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. There are a couple of opportunities to hear our program each week. We originate Friday mornings at 10 o'clock on Ideas 90.3. We repeat Friday evenings at 7 p.m. on NPR News and Music 88.9. The show is produced by Dawn Jewell. I'm Ezra Wall, and we'll be back next week for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.